Well, hello. Good morning, Peninsula Community Church. He is risen.
He is risen.
See, I'm like, Paul, I know you. I said it. Now I feel that. Well, my name is Andrew, if you are new with us. I'm actually the student ministries pastor, but with the help of Bruce, both of us have been kind of filling in for Pastor Jim as he's on sabbatical, and so that means that I am here and I get to lead Easter. And before you get maybe a little too worried, just know that the one nice thing is usually when the youth pastor speaks, everyone goes home early. So, you know, keep that in your back pocket. It's okay. Well, so today what's happening is not just that it's Easter, but we're also looking at the final part of our series, this Better Jesus Is series. And if you haven't been with us, what we've been doing is we've been looking at all the miracles in John as they lead up to this one. And see, all the miracles in John, what they're doing is they're revealing another layer of who Jesus is, both his character and his authority. The thing is, though, they all point to today, because in today, everything changes. The miracle of the resurrection changes everything. It changes how we live. It changes everything. And so I started to think, you know, how can I start this off? What are things in life that we experience or we see or we learn about that changes the way that we do something? And you know, with kids, and it's a little easier probably in youth because I could talk about school or something like that, but then I thought, you know, it's a little different with adults because we like to get in our routines. You know, we like to find the places we like to sit in church or what we like to do, and we kind of like the way we have things. And so I started to think, well, what kind of things do we experience as we get older that kind of changes how we look or how we see something? And that's when I thought of it. Do you guys know what a life hack is? It's basically what the title is. It's a way to hack life in order to enjoy something better or to enjoy something cheaper or to get creative or something like that. Like, for example, did you know you've been eating Oreos wrong your whole life? Did you know that? See, if you're like me, you love Oreos. I mean, they're a wonderful snack. And the advertising is right. They go great with milk. But the problem with Oreos, I don't know if you know, is sometimes you get stuck with kind of a glass like this one. And if you use a glass like this one, what you find is it's quite hard to dip. I feel like kind of one of those people in those commercials that's like struggling with simple things. But it's true, okay? You find that challenge. And so usually you overfill your glass or you make a mess or something like that. You've been eating Oreos wrong your whole life. But if you want to change the way you do something, next time you have Oreos, bring with you a fork. Okay, so you bring a fork, and all you do is you stick it right in between. Now you have like an Oreo wand. Okay, you got an Oreo wand, and you know, just to prove that it works, okay, I'm just going to get my milk right here. I'm not going to overfill. I'm going to put a decent amount because, you know, got to enjoy it. You don't have to go too crazy. You get your Oreo wand. It's good to go. Look, easy dipping. Yeah. And then it's just free to enjoy. I got to tell you, a morning Oreo hits way differently. I'm not... Save it for late night. Now, because I know... After service, you're all going to be running out to the store and buying tons of Oreos. I thought I'd give you one more life hack. See, one thing, and I would say it's a flaw about me, is that I'm one of these people that I like to call one trippers. When I go grocery shopping and I'm coming back, I only like to take one trip to carry my groceries up. And usually this creates problems, and it leaves the potential to drop stuff or create a mess. But if you're like me and you're like, I got to do it in one trip, I live in an apartment, I don't want to go up the stairs a bunch of times, I do have one more life hack for you. Now, this is an easy one for me because I use this in my everyday life. But if you have a carabiner, and I use it for my keys, you can actually carry multiple groceries in a whole different way. So you just take your groceries and you just attach your carabiner. Of course, it's a little harder now that they're recycled bags, but take your carabiner right through, and instead of those days where you and your siblings would go to the back of the van and would just stick out your arms as one of them just piled groceries on your arms. Now you've got a carabiner right here that provides like a little hook and carries 50 pounds. You could do anything in one trip with that. And so I thought about these life hacks because I was thinking, here's these small things that can change the way we do something. But today is more than a life hack. It's a life changer. See, today, it's not just a small thing to change one element of our life. When we interact with the resurrection, it changes everything. It changes everything. And that kind of brings us to our big idea. Because our big idea is taking this life hack to a whole nother level. It changes everything. And this is our big idea. Our Jesus is for today. And it's Jesus is the risen one. So Jesus is the risen one. See, every other miracle in John has been building towards this. It's been building and illuminating another element of Jesus' character, another element of Jesus' power, all of them pointing to this today. He's the risen one. He's different from the failed other movements that have happened. He's different. With the resurrection, he's showing them that he's the one. He's the one that they have been waiting for, and he's the one that we have been waiting for. And so kind of the challenge of today and where I want to be leading is, if you embrace the risen one, if you embrace Jesus as the risen one, well, it changes everything. Now today, Easter, this resurrection, this is Scripture's biggest claim. And I think it's a pretty bold one too, right? God incarnate, Jesus, died and rose again and is risen currently. This is a big claim. I mean, it's so big, the religious opposition knew that in order to kill off the Jesus moment, they had to make sure something like this didn't happen. They sealed the tomb. They guarded it. They did everything they could to make sure something wouldn't happen. Because they knew without a resurrection, this moment, this movement was over. What they didn't realize, though, is that when the resurrection came, everything else changed with it. See, I think for the followers of Jesus, they were all changed that first Sunday morning. Gone was hopelessness, and now hope was brought in, and it was brought to a level it was never experienced before. That first Sunday changed everything for all of the disciples. Well, I think all of them except for one, and that's where we're going today. If you have your Bibles, turn to John chapter 20. In just a moment, we'll pick up in verse 24, but see, today, we're going to do something maybe a little different than your average Easter Sunday service. And to be fair, I don't think this has been an average kind of common year, and so I think it can call for that. Today, we're going to look at the disciple you saw on the screen before, Thomas. Thomas is one of the original 12 disciples. He had left everything to follow Jesus. He left his business, and he followed Jesus for 3 years. And now Thomas was convinced Jesus was going to change the world. And he was bold about it. He was willing to follow Jesus. If you remember from the video and you remember from last week, Thomas was the one that rallied the disciples to go back to Jerusalem with Jesus, even if it meant they would die. He was that willing to follow Jesus. But I think what we see in this story is that when the authorities crucified Jesus, all of a sudden that passion, it turned to hopelessness. See, for Thomas, he was left now with just hopelessness and discouragement. Every dream he had about the future, every dream he had about what Jesus was doing was crushed. And so Thomas ran away. Now, what's interesting is that Thomas wasn't there that first Sunday. And so if you think back to like all the classic Easter Sunday messages and all the classic Easter Sunday moments, Thomas wasn't there. He was gone. He wasn't there when Mary went to the tomb and found it empty, and then, the story with Jesus being there. He wasn't there. He wasn't there when Peter interacted with Jesus. He wasn't even there when Jesus first appeared in the locked room and showed everyone his scars. Thomas was gone. He missed out. And because of that, when Thomas returns, he finds the disciples in a different place than he left them. All of a sudden, he's coming back with this discouragement and hopelessness, and they've changed. And they're telling him through their joy and their excitement all these crazy stories about what had happened. And to me, it almost feels like when you're out with friends And maybe like a, you know, like a childhood friend or something comes up and they're like sharing all these old stories. And it's kind of like the, oh, you had to be there kind of moment. Like, oh, you had to be there to really get what we're saying. And so Thomas, I think, as you can expect, was skeptical. He's risen? That sounds too good to be true. I saw him die. And the only one I've ever seen raise someone from the dead was him. And so who's going to raise him? I think Thomas knew. He knew that if this was real, it would change everything. And so he was skeptical. He didn't want to just follow a memory of Jesus. He didn't want to follow a fantasy of Jesus. He wanted to follow the Jesus he had just followed for 3 years. He wanted the real thing. And so Thomas makes a pretty bold claim. A pretty high set of conditions he needs satisfied in order for him to believe. And that's where we're picking up today. So hopefully you have made it there. We're at John 20, and we're starting in verse 24. It says, "Now Thomas, one of the 12, was with the disciples when Jesus came." That was important. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, and put my fingers where the nails were, and put my hands in his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hand. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen me and yet have believed." Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. Now, Thomas, as many of you know, he has a moniker, he has a nickname, right, that we have given him throughout the years, usually people like me who are standing up here on stage. It's that nickname of Doubting Thomas, right? We've given him that nickname. And I think it's a label that preachers and speakers have given him throughout the time to teach a lesson, but also to criticize him as they teach that lesson. And I think, though, sort of like what we saw with Martha last week, it's almost a little bit of a one-dimensional look, because I think really what we see in this story is a little deeper than that, because we're going to see something amazing about how Jesus interacts with Thomas in his pain, in his trouble, and in his doubts. Thomas wasn't the only one that struggles. He gets the nickname, but he wasn't the only one that doubted. Many of the disciples admit to losing hope. A lot of them deserted Jesus in those first moments. Peter, for example, he denies Jesus 3 times. Thomas wasn't the only one who experienced a crisis. But I think through this story, and what I hope you see this Easter, is a few things, and it's a few things that come out of this crisis that Thomas is dealing with. And the first one is this: crisis can be a doorway to deeper faith. Crisis can be a doorway to deeper faith. Now, the beginning of this passage, I think, creates a little bit of tension. I don't know if you caught it, but there's something in there that stuck out to me right away. It's verse 26. Verse 26 stuck out to me right away. It says, "A week later." So we kind of have a timeline being built where Thomas is gone for that first Sunday, but then he returns, and he comes back, and he hears all these stories. But then the tension arrives in verse 26 when it says, "A week later." So the story isn't happening right away. There's a week that passes. Thomas didn't only have to struggle from Friday to Sunday. He had to struggle a little bit longer than the rest of them because he missed out. Jesus waited a week while Thomas was listening to everyone else. And I think that's the tension. We sometimes get these why moments in the Bible, right? Why did Jesus wait a week and let Thomas experience that? Well, sometimes when we hit these whys, we got to stop and just say, well, they're incredibly tough to answer. It's hard to answer the why, but what we see is he did. And what we've seen throughout these miracles, because remember, they've been building towards this one, is that Jesus moves very intentionally. He's not making things up as he goes. He's moving very intentionally. Just like last week when we looked at Lazarus, Jesus has a perspective that's much wider than what we're looking at. And so he's moving intentionally when he does this. And I think, not an answer, but one thing that I think great comes from this is actually an encouragement to us. Because while Thomas waited a week in his struggle, we actually see something in a sense that we need to take and that we need to be doing as well. Because what's encouraging to me is that Thomas didn't struggle alone. Thomas didn't struggle alone. The disciples experienced something that completely changed them. They had the stories, right? Their hopelessness was gone. They were full of joy. They were full of excitement. They had purpose. They had direction. And there was Thomas. He had none of it. He was kind of the Debbie Downer. He was kind of the, you know, bringing everyone down in the group. He's killing the vibe. And even though the other disciples experienced something that changed them, they didn't leave Thomas behind. I think it would have been really easy to leave Thomas behind, to just kind of be like, hey, you're kind of bringing us down. Like, let's just come back in a little bit. We'll tell you when we have the big meetings, but until then, just kind of, you know, go do your own thing. But because everything changed for them, they didn't want him to miss out. They didn't want to leave him behind. They had faith that he would experience what they did. But Thomas was in the midst of a crisis. And I think if we're honest, we don't like crisis. We don't like that feeling. It's not a fun state to be in. But I think what we see through this story, and hopefully what we'll see through our own lives as well, is that sometimes times of crisis can be a catalyst to deepen our faith. I know just even this last year, we've been in the midst of going through several different crises, and it's not hard to imagine that several of us have gone through different ones. We could be experiencing a crisis of an intellectual nature, kind of like Thomas, where we've hit a wall. We've hit something that is so hard to wrap our mind around. Thomas couldn't wrap his mind around the idea that Jesus is alive. He saw him die. He knew he was dead, and he was certain of that. So he struggled to wrap his mind around it. We can experience the crisis of trying to wrap our minds around the difficult questions of life, or the difficult questions we experience here. I think we can experience as well, and there could be several of us that are experiencing the crisis of culture. Now, I'm a student ministry director, and so I work with youth. I work with the young people, and really a lot of my focus is studying what's happening with them and studying how the church moves with them and how we can reach people. And so I think kind of one thing actually we've seen, especially with the young people, is this crisis of culture, where we wrestle with the culture in the world, yes, but also we wrestle with the culture here in the church as well, how Christians have responded. I think in this last year, we've seen many step away from the church because they don't feel that same trust. That breaks my heart. When the church was pressed this year, people didn't always like what they saw. And so there's this crisis that you may be dealing with of culture. I think there's a crisis of an emotional crisis. When the disciples were gathered together, Thomas was AWOL. He wasn't there. He was gone. Because he was devastated. He was wounded. He was hurting. He was broken. He lost all hope. You know what that feels like? I think many of us have gone through a devastating season. And the hard thing is sometimes this answer of faith doesn't always hit the same way. It doesn't sound like the antidote. And so you're in this emotional crisis and you don't know how to get out. Or you're in a spiritual crisis. Thomas, I have to imagine that whole week of waiting, wondered, why didn't Jesus show up for me the same way he showed up for them? Why am I not feeling what they're feeling? Why does my faith hit differently? You know, I'm a big believer in camp. I love camps. I was so sad last year to not have a camp. I've been going to camp since I was 2 weeks old. So you could say I'm a camp expert. And I think one thing you see at camps is you see people have different reactions to the camp. There's the people that go and they have a great time, they have a lot of fun, they get to hang out with their friends. But then you kind of talk to them, you get sort of this meh response. Like, yeah, I enjoyed it, but I didn't, you know, that's kind of what I got. And then you kind of have these people where all of a sudden something clicked. You know, they're coming home crying on the last night. All of a sudden, you know, they feel this moment, this powerful experience where they experience God in a different way. And I don't think it's hard for us to experience the spiritual crisis of seeing those around us and wondering, why doesn't my faith feel as easy as theirs does? Why doesn't it feel as fun as theirs does? Why are they connected more? And so Thomas was in the midst of this crisis. I think the scary thing is when we are in the midst of these, the tension really is to ignore them, to pretend they don't exist, or like Thomas, to run away. Or perhaps even worse is that when we see others in this crisis, the tension is to get uncomfortable. This is easy. To not empathize the way that we could, to be afraid of the mess. Like I said, though, my background's in students, and so I spend a lot of time with them, and I spend a lot of time reading up on stuff for them, and one great resource is a book called Sticky Faith, and the idea is to create a sticky faith, a faith that lasts, so not just, you know, you come to youth group, but that you're the future of the church. And so they're studying this, and they're trying to find out, well, how do we keep kids connected into the church after they leave youth group? And one of the interesting things is they actually, in their research, found that around 70% of the high school kids in youth groups experience these crises of serious doubt. But only a quarter of them ever talk about it. Only a quarter of them ever talk about it. And I think that's one of the things that just scares me. Because in the research, well, one of the authors noted, and he wrote, is that it's not doubt that's toxic to faith, but it's silence. This is part of our walk. But silence is the part that is scary, because we actually have a chance in the midst of crisis to create deeper faith. But sadly, I think we've been taught to often suppress it. Now, you probably figured, because when I said I went to my first camp at 2 weeks old, I'm what is lovingly referred to as a church rat. A church rat. It's a compliment, don't worry. It's, you know, I take it as one at least. So I was a staff kid, and what that means is that I didn't just go to church on Sundays. I was there all the time. I grew up on the playground. I grew up probably sleeping under some of the desks in the office. I was there. And so being a church kid, I understand firsthand the tension to just suppress crisis. Because, like, if I'm feeling that, what does that mean? Am I allowed to feel that way? Am I going to get my dad in trouble if I feel this way? There's that tension. But I think I can honestly tell you that I'm only here today, first and foremost, because people constantly prayed for me. People constantly prayed for me. My grandma has a mug. Actually, now she has one of our church. She used to have a mug of my school, and she'd use it for coffee every day, and then she would pray for me as she did. And so I really think I'm here because people pray for me. But also because I had people, probably why I'm in youth ministry, I had youth leaders that were willing to walk with me in crisis. They took the example of the disciples, and they stayed with me. I think where Thomas deserves some credit, though, is that Thomas was the bold guy. He was kind of the bold guy of the group. He often said the tough things or asked the tough questions. Thomas was the one. He's kind of like the kid in class or the adult in the adult class that isn't afraid to ask the questions that everyone's thinking. You know, you all need that one person in class that's like, okay, I'll raise my hand. I'll ask the question that you're all wondering, but none of you want to ask. Thomas was that guy. In John 14, when Jesus says, "You know the way," and all the disciples were probably super confused, Thomas is the one that says, "Lord, we do not know where you're going. How do we know the way?" Thomas was the bold guy. He asked the bold questions. And so, where Thomas, I think, did something very right in this story is that Thomas was willing to put his feelings of hopelessness into words. Thomas didn't keep them buried. He was willing to put them to words. And so that phrase that we often like to criticize, I think actually can bring out some hope, where he says, unless I see the nail marks on his hand and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand in your side, I will not believe. I mean, yeah, that's a bold statement, but it's coming from his hopelessness, and he's putting it into words. He's saying, look, I walked with Jesus. I talked with Jesus. I've seen the miracles. And now I'm in a state of hopelessness. I want to believe, but I want to believe in the real risen Jesus. I don't want to celebrate a memory. I don't want to celebrate a fantasy. I want the real Jesus that I had just been walking with. So show me the nails. The part of the story that I want to lean into, it's not just how Thomas responds or how Thomas is in crisis, but really is the idea of how does Jesus feel? How does Jesus feel about people in crisis? How does he treat Thomas? Because ultimately, Jesus does appear. Yeah, it took a week, but Jesus appears and addresses Thomas in his crisis. And just like we saw last week with Mary and his interaction with Mary, and now we see again today, Jesus meets us in our crises. He meets us. When Jesus shows up, he doesn't belittle Thomas. What he does is he shows up and he appears to the neediest person in the room first. He immediately goes to the person that needs him the most, and he knows exactly what Thomas is going through. He even repeats his demands word for word, even though he wasn't there. My imagination might be getting away from me, but I almost imagine this just humble kind of Jesus appearing and just kind of like, oh, Thomas, hi. You know, I heard something this last week that you said something about wanting to touch my scars. Well, come here. Let's do it. Bring that finger. Let's get this going. Throughout the miracles, we've seen this intimacy. It's been a clear theme. I think in almost every single one, this intimacy of the risen one. And here he goes to the disciple that needs him most and gives him what he needs most. He's telling Thomas, it's okay. It's okay. You can place your complete trust in me. You can give me your confidence. I'm not going to let you down. I'm here. I'm real. And I'm not going to abandon you. Jesus meets people in their crises. He met Peter in his crisis of his failure. He met his brother James in the crisis of his doubt, and he met Saul, soon to be Paul, in the crisis of his rebellion. And he does this, I think, to build deeper faith. You know, faith is a word we like to use a lot and speak a lot, but I think one thing sometimes we miss about faith is that faith in the Bible is depicted as dynamic. It's dynamic. It's renewed with each new revelation we learn about Jesus, but it's dynamic. So faith, believing and unbelieving are active. It's not just something that happens one time at a church camp or on a Sunday morning or something like that. Faith is continual. And so really we're always growing in one direction or the other. It's dynamic. And so if we're really to translate this interaction of Jesus in a much more, I'd say like wooden fashion, where it's like word for word without making it sound better in English, what you read is Jesus saying, stop becoming unbelieving and get on becoming believing. It's a continual process. He's getting Thomas back on the path. You know what's interesting, and I actually noticed it in the video again, but what's interesting here in this passage, as Jesus is moving Thomas in the right direction, something jumped out at me. John, who writes this, he never actually mentions Thomas feeling the wounds. Did you notice that? He never mentions it. I mean, we always imagine it, and the video kind of showed it too, but he doesn't actually describe it happening. Instead, John jumps straight to Thomas's response, where Thomas says, my Lord, my God. Did Thomas need as many signs as he thought? But right when he interacted with the risen Jesus, all of a sudden, everything changed for him. And so Thomas gives this confession. A confession of faith, but a confession of trust, of saying, my Lord and my God, I'm going to follow you. All because the risen Jesus met Thomas in his crisis. And so when Thomas embraced Jesus as the risen one, everything changed for him. Kind of like last week with Martha, you know, we only focus on Thomas on this one story, but this isn't the end of the story for Thomas. This isn't the only thing we know about him. See, Thomas, he lived out this faith. He took this story and grew in a dynamic way. Just a little trivia for you. You can, you know, bring it up at a dinner party or something. Thomas is actually known as the apostle to India. So Thomas is famous for being the apostle to India, and scholars say sometime between the year 52 AD and 72 AD, he led the largest mission ever to India. So much so that he actually left a mark on the country. I think we might have a picture of some of the things that really left a mark on the country. Maybe not. And so Thomas left a whole mark on the country because his dynamic faith, his doubt was turned to dynamic faith, a faith that left its mark, not just on a person, but a country, and a faith that he rode all the way to the end. When Thomas was one day pressed about his faith and told to give it up or to die here, he did, like he said in the video, he never abandoned the one who came for him. I think the resurrected Jesus never left anyone indifferent. Thomas wasn't left indifferent. Everything changed for him, and it's because it all comes back to who Jesus is. It all comes back to who Jesus is. The story of Thomas is only what it is because of who Jesus is. In one interaction, Jesus is able to show his power and his authority over death while also showing his profound intimacy for his followers. Jesus came personally to Thomas as the risen one, the one that he knew and he had walked with and he had talked with, and when he had seen, he came personally to him. Thomas wanted the real Jesus. He was skeptical because he wanted the real Jesus. He didn't want a fantasy. He didn't want a memory, a phantom, or anything like that. He wanted the risen one. And I think our faith needs to be the same. We come here today because we worship the risen one, who is still risen. We don't worship a phantom Jesus or a fantasy Jesus or even a memory of Jesus. We worship the Jesus who is risen. So I think kind of the challenge is this. Will you invite the risen Jesus to deepen your faith? One moment, sorry. Will you invite the risen Jesus to deepen your faith? No matter where you are, faith is dynamic. It's not a moment. It's not a one-time decision. It's a dynamic process. And so if you are new or you're a guest, or this is your first time kind of hearing stuff, will you invite the risen Jesus to deepen your faith, to start you on that process? And we have people here for you and people that want to interact with you. And even if you're on home and you just have the chat, we still have people that are here for you. Even if you're a founding member of the church, will you still invite the risen Jesus to deepen your faith? Because no matter where we are, we can continue to invite him to interact and deepen our faith. Because when we embrace the risen Jesus, everything changes for us. Will you join me as we pray? God, we come before you today on this Resurrection Sunday, leaning into who you are, leaning into you as the resurrected one. God, so I just pray that no matter where we are, that we will ask you to deepen our faith. We'll ask the one who is resurrected, who is still living, not just a memory, but is real and is living, to deepen us into you, into a relationship with you, God. And so grow us. And like Thomas, call us to a dynamic faith that leaves a mark on a people, that shows people who you are. And so we just pray this in your name. Amen.